You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, January 26, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
How's everyone this lovely Wednesday, deep winter, cold, frigid day?
Oh, no, it's cold.
Yes.
Oh, God, Kara.
It's super cold.
It's one of those days, Kara, you go outside for about 2 seconds, and then you're like, oh, my God, it's cold.
Nope.
The high today was 72, I think, in L.A. So that's like 22 for all you Celsius listeners.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was... It's nice.
-4 here right now. -4 Celsius.
So get this. We retweeted this on our Twitter account. By the way, if you don't follow us on Twitter, do. We do put some information there for you. And we retweeted this thing. The Ron DeSantis, he's the governor of Florida, his nominee for Surgeon General, refused to answer 4 times, yes or no, do the COVID vaccines work? Wouldn't answer the question,
what?
Yes or no.
He would not answer that?
How did he answer?
His first answer was, the question is a scientific one. That was the entirety of his answer.
Yeah, and you're a scientist or a physician, or you should be, if you're being nominated for this position.
So when he was pushed to answer yes or no, and his answer was, a scientist who could answer any specific scientific questions. So he's saying that he was a scientist who could answer any specific scientific questions. Like, go ahead, give me your questions.
I just did,
yes or no.
And he did that one.
He did say reasonable effectiveness for the prevention of hospitalization and death and relatively low effectiveness for prevention, which is not really true.
No, it's not true at all.
Yeah.
So what role is he trying to fill?
Didn't feel comfortable saying, yes, the vaccines work. Did not feel comfortable saying that.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's where we are.
Yep.
What's he going to be, a surgeon private?
Science. Yeah.
All right, so the bottom line is that he doesn't believe it or refuses to acknowledge it.
Oh, he's pandering.
Or politically speaking, he can't acknowledge it.
He did not feel comfortable saying that. Like, it was politically incorrect to say, yeah, the vaccines work. They're effective. That was politically a no-go.
Pathetic. But what goes on in the mind of somebody who hopefully, I mean, he must know the truth.
Of course he does.
Right?
I mean, he's a doctor. He knows.
Yeah. Like, it must feel not good in his heart, you know, to be sort of struggling with that.
Assumes he has one.
But Kara, it shows you in the order of importance in certain people's minds.
Right.
You know, everybody
right.
has that. That right. politics is much more important than science. Unfortunately, his paycheck is tied to him keeping his mouth shut.
The thing is, a surgeon general should be like an apolitical position.
Correct.
Absolutely. Correct. Not just bipartisan, apolitical.
Apolitical.
Yeah.
Totally. We need those people in the government, you know, people who can provide from a neutral, apolitical, non-ideological point of view. Here are the facts. This is what the experts say. This is what's true. So we can't even agree on what's true anymore, even when these are basic established facts.
She
was. Right.
That's a problem.
We can all point to outcome evidence, solid outcome evidence that's been reproduced that we wish weren't the case, right? That like doesn't align with something that we want to be true. But the fact is it's true and we have to be comfortable. We have to have the neuropsychological humility, as we always talk about, to say, I don't like it, but this is what the science shows.
Right.
Now, there was a recent anti-vaccine rally in D.C., and it was kind of an all-purpose conspiracy rally. You know, even though it was
got some QAnon thrown in,
ostensibly anti-vaccine, but everything was there. You know,
sure.
Guess who was like one of the big
Kennedy.
Figures? Yeah, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Of course,
Robert F. Kennedy around.
Yeah. Oh, come on, what's the matter with him, Steve?
Oh my gosh, what vaccines causes autism, right,
I know,
Robert?
I know.
This guy is. I mean, I thought, again, you try to figure out what happened to this guy. He started out as an environmentalist, and somehow he went down the rabbit hole of anti-vaccine. And I suspect he is just completely buried in a process of confirmation bias and motivated reasoning.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
right. He's just now he's found so much evidence to confirm his belief that he's done. He's just done. He said at the rally, if you take the vaccine, you have a 21% increased chance of dying over the next 6 months.
What?
Where did that come from? Nowhere.
Yeah.
Wow. Absolutely nowhere. But what he does, like a lot of anti-vaxxers do, is he does what we call dumpster diving in the VAERS, you know, reporting database.
Oh, the VAERS.
This is just an open, unfiltered, you know, voluntary reporting system. It's not scientific information. You could basically, it's a Rorschach test. You could see.
Sounds like you read anything into it.
Huh? Yeah. Meanwhile, the CDC data found in the during October, November, guess how much more likely were you to die from COVID if you were unvaccinated versus somebody who was fully vaccinated?
18 times. Like
20 yes. times? Or
probably 45 times?
53 yeah. times.
Whoa, yeah.
53 times the risk of death. 53 times the risk of death. Can you imagine?
Yeah, but those are your facts.
Right, but if you can't trust the CDC, right? So you get to make up your own facts by
exactly.
just... by doing unscientific observations in a completely, you know, unscientific database.
It's like a flat earther mentality. They're so
yeah, totally.
So steeped in it, and they can never come out of it. They don't want to emerge from it. It is their reality, and they're so comfortable in it. They'll never leave it, ever abandon it.
The yeah. problem is, this is one of those situations in which reality, not only does reality exist, reality has, it's violent in this situation.
It's pounding on the door. Reality yeah. is that people are dying
yes.
and tons of people are catching, you know, are catching this virus. And the vaccine so unbelievably clearly benefits everybody who takes it. And if you turn a blind eye to that, you are intellectually compromised. On
and
some level.
You're harming public health.
Here's some good news. A couple of recent studies I want to point out. One showed that if you either were infected with COVID and then later got vaccinated,
yeah.
or you were vaccinated and had a breakthrough infection, you get this hybrid super immunity.
It's a hybrid.
With 10 times the antibodies as being vaccinated alone
wow.
or being
what?
Infected alone.
What?
10 times the antibodies.
Jay, so man, you're Superman, dude.
That's awesome. For how long?
Yeah,
well, we don't know that.
5 minutes.
yeah, there's a half-life.
Time will tell.
10 minutes.
Now, that's good in that with the spread of Omicron and with the spread of vaccines, this is one of the paths that we can get to the pandemic burning itself out and just turning into another flu, cold, sort of endemic respiratory virus. Now, I do have to emphasize, this doesn't mean, like, if you're fully vaccinated, go out and get COVID. It doesn't mean that at all. Again, the whole point is to not get COVID. And getting COVID is a really terrible way of not getting COVID.
Right.
It just really doesn't work. I've really studied this extensively, and I'm pretty sure that getting COVID is the worst way to avoid getting COVID.
But that begs the question, how can you induce that super immunity without getting COVID?
Boosters,
yeah,
probably.
No, I doubt that.
But the thing is, if you get fully boosted, you're fine. You have good effectiveness against even
But I
the new
want
variants.
Super immunity.
But
wear a mask.
I caught COVID.
It's still important to avoid COVID
more.
For a few reasons. First, you know, it's not a benign illness. Even if you are, if it's a breakthrough infection and you are vaccinated, you're much, much better off being vaccinated. But you can still get some annoying long COVID symptoms. Mm-hmm. I know people who have lost their taste and it's, you know, taking a long
that
time
sucks.
To come back or doesn't come back fully or the same the way it was before. Like there's just something off about it.
Frankly, some people never had taste to begin with, but go ahead.
That's true. But in any case, it's not so benign that you should seek it out just for the extra immunity so that you don't get it. Again, it doesn't even make sense. And don't think this is going to help end the pandemic because every infection is adding to the probability of more variants emerging.
Yes.
So it's not good. So don't still try not to get infected, you know, wear a mask, social distance, avoid people who are known to be infected, et cetera, get fully boosted. But if you do get it, you're likely to have a very mild illness and it will give you enhanced immunity beyond just being vaccinated or just getting infected alone. The other bit of good news is that the Pfizer CEO just announced that they are ready with an Omicron version of their vaccine.
Wow.
I'm
which
so
will be,
excited.
Will be released in March.
Nice.
I wonder how long you will have had to wait.
Yeah, there still remains to be seen. But
so
I
the
do
next
think,
booster then. That'll be the next
yeah,
booster.
Right,
the next
like,
booster
we
will
were
cover
boosted,
Omicron.
I was yeah. boosted in October. I want that Omicron booster. Gimme, gimme. I'm feeling like by the day, it's been too long, you know? I'm scared.
Well, I think so boosting creates higher antibody titers than just being fully vaccinated. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll also produce longer immunity, which tends to happen. The more number of times you get you get boosted, the longer lasting your immunity is. That's probably true. Again, I'm hoping, and I think this is reasonable, that we'll settle into an annual COVID vaccine with the flu vaccine, and they'll track the variants just like they track the variants with flu.
Yeah.
And that's it. It'll just be one more, you know, flu-like. Again, this is, again, what happens. Populations just build up more and more and more immunity to an infection until it becomes like the cold or the flu. You know,
can they combine the two into one, the flu vaccination and the COVID vaccination?
Probably.
Theoretically, I don't know if they will.
And it might not be worthwhile.
There may be technical reasons why they don't. Be, you know, especially if like an mRNA might need different preservatives. And unless they make an mRNA flu vaccine that's compatible. But getting two jabs is no big deal. You go, here's your flu, here's your COVID.
I got mine at the same time.
No big deal.
But wouldn't the rate be higher if it were one shot as opposed to two for most for people?
I would think that's how the numbers would work out. If they can do it, they probably will, but I wouldn't count on that, especially with the fact that they're different kinds of vaccines. So
don't like elderly or immunocompromised people often take a different flu shot?
There's a high dose.
Yeah, there's like a high dose flu shot. Yeah. And then there's
the quadrivalent versus the trivalent.
Yeah.
I always, when they ask me, I'm like, give me the high dose quadrivalent, please. I want the whole full, both.
Wow. Oh, yeah. Why don't, like, that's a good idea. It's like, so we can just ask for the quadrivalent
and sprinkle some. Yeah.
Because I'm a hospital worker. I don't know if it's because I'm a healthcare worker. You probably can get a care.
Yeah. Yeah.
So because you're a healthcare worker, you can get the high dose if you want. Like, give it to me. I'll take the high dose.
I don't want the flu.
Flu's horrible.
They're both fine. It's just, you know, if I want the extra. I'll take
mine. Mine.
All right.
May I help you? You look at the menu. I think I'll have the high dose today.
Well, now they have the quadrivalent. You know, they basically just have, they've permanently added the swine flu, you know, the H1N1. It's not just a permanent part of the flu vaccine. Right? That makes sense. I think that's what's going to happen. There's just going to be more and more vaccines in our life. That's going to give us immunity against these, you know, increasing zoonotic infections. And, you know, the anti-vaxxers, man, we just got to, they're not going away. We know they're not going away, but we've got to marginalize the hell out of them. You know,
because this is
our primary weapon.
Yeah.
It's got to be like, oh, you're an anti-vaxxer. You're weird. Yeah,
right. Exactly.
Absolutely. All right. Carrie, you're going to do a what's the word this week.
I am. It's been a bit. So it's time for a new What's the Word, and this one is a little bit different than usual in that I found a word I liked, realized there were a bunch of other versions sort of it or alternate forms, want to dig into all of them. So I know we've recently been talking about evolution, as in we always are talking about evolution, one of our favorite topics on the show. And did you know that many evolutionists and ecologists actually look at speciation and categorize speciation differently based on different characteristics? Most of these categorical systems fall into five different types of speciation. Allopatric, peripatric, parapatric, sympatric, and artificial.
Not St. Patrick.
And not St. Patrick, yeah. So we'll start with artificial because that's not really etymologically interesting, at least not for this discussion. Artificial speciation is just speciation made by human beings, right? When maybe in a lab we are inventing a new species in order to be able to utilize it for laboratory studies. We do this a lot with fruit flies and things like that. That's artificial speciation. We put that one on the shelf. But the other four types all have the same suffix. Patrick. Do we know where Patrick comes from?
Ireland.
And
but you're right. Like you're kind of on the right on the right path. What do we think of when we think of Patrick? Pater.
Father.
Father.
Oh, Patronus,
yes.
Right.
Yes. So all these different Patricks are referring to, quote, the fatherland. They're referring to the ecological geographic region where these organisms exist. And so allopatric speciation, which is one of the most common, one of the ones that I think is the most recognizable for us because we think of Darwin's finches, it occurs when basically one group, one species, separates into two groups because of a physical barrier, geographic barrier, isolation. So a mountain, a river, an ocean. And when we look at the word allopatric, well, what does allo, the prefix, mean? It comes from the original Greek, and it means other. And here's an interesting thing that I'm sure, Steve, you know, and maybe many of the guys on the show know, but I came to because I was not steeped in the skeptic dictionary the way that you guys were for so long. When we hear the term allopathic medicine, which is an antiquated word and a derogatory word, it was actually invented by Samuel Hahnemann, the inventor of homeopathy. So he coined the term allopathic to mean other medicine.
As in non-medicine.
When really it is medicine. So that's
It's like homeopathic is working with the body, and allopathic is medicine that works against the body. I think that was more the idea.
But the word allo,
it's from the outside. It's other. Yeah, it's
other. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The other, the outside, the kind of, yeah. So when we think of allopatric, not allopathic, but allopatric speciation, it's when one group is othered from it, right? So you've got this one group that splits off into two, and they are othered from each other. And of course, the classic example is Darwin's finches. This finch has this type of beak because it has this type of food source on this island. This finch has this other. They are now different species because of that.
Yeah, so they're in different locations, I think is the simple way to put it. They evolved into different species because they were geographically separated,
as opposed to being together.
They're in the same place, but just in different niches, right?
Right. But peripatric and parapatric are sort of in between. So peripatry, the root for that, meaning around, about, or enclosing. And, you know, we've heard that with different scientific peri, whatever. And so peripatric is a situation where there are still physical barriers that make it hard for these groups to interbreed, but one group is much smaller than another. So you don't really see equal groups. You see the main species group, and then you see the small offshoot. That's peripatric. In parapatric, which, what does para mean? What's that root? This one's brutal. It means beside, alongside, between, around, like surrounding, parallel. Adjacent, parallel, near, but also opposite, on the far side.
Yeah.
This one's kind of frustrating because you can kind of use it a lot of different ways. But parapatric speciation specifically is when the geographic area is just so big that it's hard for different groups to mate with one another. So there may not be a physical boundary, like a mountain range or a river, but it's just so far spread out that even though they technically are in the same like biome or the same ecological area, they're just not mating because they're physically far away from one another.
It's far away. That would be like orca in different oceans. They're connected, but they're just far away.
But they're just really far away. And then you mentioned, Steve, sort of the quote opposite of allopatric, which is sympatric speciation. And sympatric speciation is sort of controversial. Like some scientists don't think this is a cause of speciation. They think there's other reasons behind why these species in these situations would have speciated. But the idea here is that there aren't any physical barriers. They're in close proximity to one another. And a new species spontaneously emerges, maybe because of a different characteristic, a different food source, different mating choices. And some researchers say, no, we think there has to be a boundary or a barrier or a physical reason. And it could be that something happened a long time ago and then they came back together, or there's some other reason that they're now cohabitating. That's not the right word, but occupying the same space, that they're now sympatric. And sim, of course, comes from together, joint, right?
Yeah.
Like sin or sim. So this is one of those fun situations where the science makes sense. You see this a lot in anatomy where you're like, I get why that is called that, because that is the Latin or Greek root. And that is a perfect...
adrenal is on top of the renals.
So exactly. What an easy label to understand. Yeah. I love it when it's like that. So this is a really interesting example of that. But now you know five different sources of speciation: allopatric, peripatric, parapatric, sympatric, and artificial. And if you can't remember which is which, just think back to that root.
Kara, I think of the sympatric as the sneeches. You know, maybe some of them just have stars upon stars. They don't mix with the other ones. Or you have, you can't think of it in terms of culture,
right?
Like there is assortative mating based on socioeconomic status, and that's sympatric in a way. If it got to the point where it was like the Eloys and the remember
I have Morlocks? No idea what
Morlocks. Yeah, the Morlocks and the Eloys
where machine?
They were Yeah, that was kind of a commentary on the class society where they became so separated they actually became different species.
Right, right.
The workers and the haves and the have-nots. You know.
And so that really is the question, I think, for a lot of ecologists, behaviorists, evolutionists, is there a cultural, behavioral, basically a choice, an interest, an attraction that can occur within a species that's in the same geographic region where they just say, I would rather mate with this option. And that is such a strong thing that ultimately leads to speciation. Some think that that's the case. Some think, no, there's got to be a different mechanism at play.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason to be skeptical of that is we know that, you know, different species are going to hook up or,
right.
You know, when humans and chimps divided into two different lines, for millions of years, there was some hanky-panky going on.
Oh, so
if that's the case, why wouldn't the same species be willing to mate, you know? Mm-hmm. There has to be something. It does make sense that there would need to be some kind of
something else going on. Like, and it may be the case that it happened, sure, in individual pairs or like in a certain generation, but think about how long it takes for speciation to occur in a sexually reproducing species.
Well, for example, Kara, if you have, like, if one individual has a chromosomal mutation and, you know, they have enough close relatives with that mutation where they can create a genetically incompatible subpopulation of their species, mm-hmm. there's the only reason that they become different species is genetic incompatibility, not distance.
Right.
But then
again,
we're introducing a new reason. That's what they're
saying. Exactly.
It's a
mutation for sure.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. Fun one.
So guys, I'm going to give another discussion about, is there life on Mars? Which is, you know, again, that this is one of the big scientific questions of our age. You know, if we eventually answer it in the positive, then we'll have an answer. If it's negative, it'll, I think, always be a question mark. It's always only as good as how deeply we've been able to look. But in any case, there's a new study which is once again compatible with the interpretation that at one time there was life on Mars. It doesn't have to be extant life. But of course, compatible with is not the same as evidence for, because there are other interpretations. Mm-hmm. This one has to do with carbon. Going back now to the Curiosity rover. This is the Curiosity rover is still working, even though we have the Perseverance up there.
Right.
Curiosity rover concluded an analysis of Martian rock. They basically pulverized the rock, heated it up to release gases, and analyzed the gases, looking for the carbon signature in those rocks. They looked at 24 different powdered rock samples, including some that came from rock beds that are known to be ancient. And that's kind of the point. You know, they wanted to make sure they were looking at ancient rocks because they want to see if, you know, there was ancient life on Mars. That's what they're looking for. And they're looking for the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-13. Now, I know all you guys know what isotopes are. Isotopes are different versions of an element. Have the same, you know, an element is defined by how many protons it has. But an element could have different numbers of neutrons. So a carbon-12 would be a carbon with 6 protons and 6 neutrons. Carbon-13 would be 6 protons and 7 neutrons. I know you guys know about carbon-14 dating. That involves a different isotope. Carbon-14 is not stable. It's made in the Earth's atmosphere because of cosmic rays hitting carbon in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide creates carbon-14. Carbon-14 has a half-life of, you know, over 5,000 years, 5,730 years to be precise. And so it decays into a nitrogen isotope. And you can look at the ratio, therefore, you know, plants breathe it in. Plants incorporate the carbon into their substance. We eat the plants.
Right.
And so the isotope ratios of C14 to C12 and 13 in our, you know, bodies tells us how long it's been since we've been metabolizing stuff, right? So if we died and then 10,000 years goes by, the C14 that we had incorporated will decay and the ratio of C14 to C12 will go down. That's carbon dating. But now what I'm talking about has nothing to do with any of that. It has nothing to do with carbon-14.
Right.
That's to do with carbon-12 and carbon-13, both of which are stable isotopes. They do not decay. But there is a slight difference. Now, the isotopes, generally speaking, are chemically identical. Right? Carbon is carbon. So carbon-12 and carbon-13 are chemically the same, but they are a little different. What do you think the difference is?
Well, the extra neutron.
The extra 12, neutron. The reason it's 12 or 13.
13,
yeah,
right.
which makes it a little...
More massive.
More massive, right.
So
C13 is a little heavier than C12. That means that when plants breathe in carbon dioxide from the air to incorporate, you know, into their, fix it into their sugars, they get a little bit more carbon 12 than carbon 13 because it just moves into their pores a little bit easier, right? There's a ratio of C12 to C13 in the atmosphere and in the ocean, which is about the same. The carbon cycle in the atmosphere is 98.8% C12. 1.2% C13. But the carbon in living things is 99.2% C12.
Right. But that's Earth. That's not Mars, right?
Exactly. Right. That's Earth. That is not Mars. You're exactly correct. There is a carbon cycle on Earth, and we can know if when we're looking at a ratio of carbon, you know, looking at the ratio of C12 to C13, if that came from the atmosphere or the ocean, or if it came from a living thing, which includes fossil fuels, right? Fossil fuels also have a what they call a C13 depleted ratio. There's a little bit less C13 because it's a little bit harder to get into plants just because it's a little bit slower moving, right? It's just all physics. It's moving around more slowly. So by chance alone, more C12, which is moving a little bit faster with a little bit more energy, is going to get into the plant, you know, with a slight advantage over the heavier C13. So on Earth, it's easy to tell when life has been involved, because if it's C13 depleted, if there's, you know, a higher ratio of C12 to C13 than in the air, then that's because it was concentrated by a living process. Now, we're trying to apply this to Mars. And as Bob pointed out, Mars ain't the Earth. We don't know what the carbon cycle is on Mars.
Oh, we don't.
If we knew what the carbon cycle was on Mars, then we could say, you know, what the ratio should be.
So it might, but it might be the same. It may not be the same.
But it might be the same. So what they found in the ancient rocks, or so to put it this way, what they found in some of the samples was it had depleted C13 ratios, and they were all from the ancient rocks. I don't think all of the ancient rocks had depleted, but all of the depleted samples were ancient. One of the possible processes that could deplete C13 in these samples is life, just like on Earth. But there are two other processes that can also do it. And this is the problem, right? If life were the only thing that can do it, then we would be done. We'd go, yeah, there had to be little critters crawling around a billion years ago depleting the C13 in these samples. But another one is methane. If methane gets released into the atmosphere, it gets broken down into ultraviolet light, releasing carbon, and that carbon will have a depleted C13 ratio as well. Now, on Earth, most of our methane comes from life. Also, methane's another signature of life, and we've talked about this on Mars too. Hey, there's methane in that plume on Mars. But the question is it organic methane? Is it coming from a living source, or is it just coming from a chemical process? Because chemical processes could make methane too. And so we haven't ruled out that the methane that we're seeing in the Martian atmosphere, we haven't ruled out that it could have a chemical source. In addition, that methane could be responsible for the depleted C13 ratio in the soil if there were enough of it in the right place. We don't know, but that's a possibility. The third possibility, and this one seems really speculative to me, but they said if our solar system passed through a molecular cloud containing carbon 12 sometime in the past, that could have incorporated into the soil, the ancient soil of that time period in
like
Mars.
Cosmic contamination.
Yeah, cosmic contamination with C12 might have affected the ratios.
Wow.
So that, you know, it could have happened.
Maybe.
And so that those are the three possibilities: life, methane, or a molecular cloud from space. And because we don't understand the Martian carbon cycle, we can't say which one it is. However, this is where the Perseverance probe comes in, right? So because now Curiosity is like, all right, dude, we have C13 depleted ancient rock samples here. Now over to you, Perseverance.
Right.
What Perseverance is doing
Persevering,
absolutely.
Hopefully.
It's packaging up samples and preparing them for a possible return to Earth with a later mission. Once we get those samples back on Earth, then we can start to untangle the carbon cycle on Mars in more detail. And also, you know, scientists can ask questions and propose hypotheses to try to tease apart which one of these three sources is responsible for the depleted carbon-13 ratio on Mars. So it's too soon to declare that this is evidence for life. As we know, every time this has come up so far for an extraterrestrial source of life, is it chemical or is it biological? It's turned out it's not biological. Again, so far, we know that the Venus thing that we talked about a couple years ago was a bust.
Right.
You know, all the evidence from Mars, it's tantalizing. Again, so we're still left with this tantalizing hint that maybe there could be signs of ancient life on Mars, but nothing definitive. It's kind of, I also feel the same way about every time astronomers go, there's something weird happening here. Aliens could be one of many possible explanations.
Yeah, of course.
But we always find a non-alien explanation.
Yeah.
So far, we've always found a non-biological explanation. But, you know, as we all know, Mars is a great candidate for once having had life. It had liquid water on its surface in the ancient, you know, the ancient Mars before the atmosphere got stripped away by the solar wind because it lacks a magnetic field. But it's plausible. And this will give us another data point on how likely it is for life to arise. If life independently arose on Mars in the short period of time where it had liquid water, then, you know, that tells us a lot about how likely it is, you know, and how common life is likely to be in the universe. So this is a question worth pursuing to the end, you know?
Yeah.
But of course,
get those samples home then.
These data points are coming very slowly because, yeah, when are those samples going to get back to Earth? That's going to be a long time. You know, that's like the next mission, hopefully. But it's good that NASA is prioritizing this. And there may be some things that Perseverance could figure out in situ, like on Mars with the instruments that it has there. But the real deep science is going to happen when we get those samples back to Earth. So let's hope that NASA can make that happen soon. But cool. I thought the whole carbon cycle thing was interesting.
Yeah,
no, very interesting.
Yeah. All right, Jay, this is kind of a tricky topic. You know, I read this whole article. It goes pretty deep. You're gonna tell us about what to do about these crazy school kids today and all their conspiracy theories.
Get off my lawn.
Yeah, so I read a really good article at Scientific American by Melinda Moyer. So the article is called "School Kids Are Falling Victim to Disinformation and Conspiracy Fantasies." And I, you know, it's a little alarming because especially
why should they be any different?
Conspiracy fantasies. I don't know, that kind of was alarming. Today, teachers are faced with students who deny basic facts of science and history. That's happening all across the United States. Probably, you know, this is also probably a global phenomenon, but definitely happening in the United States. Over the past 20 years, misinformation has been growing, and it has become a growing problem with students. In particular, now they're easy targets for fake news and misinformation because they're young and they simply lack the skills to assess the credibility of information. This is something that all of us have been working on most of our adult lives. It's not an easy thing to do. You know, typically around the age of 14, students will start to show signs of believing in conspiracy theories. That's pretty young. You know, I have a 9-year-old
14.
Son. You know that. You know, he's 5 years away from that, and that goes by in the blink of an eye. It's, you know, it's not, it is young. So let me give you a perfect example of what's going on. In 2016, a Stanford University study that included 8,000 students revealed that 80% of middle schoolers thought that a sponsored advertisement on a website was in fact a real news story. They couldn't see the difference or, you know, weren't able to detect the clues that are there to show you that it's an advertisement. You know, it could be the word advertisement right underneath it. And they're just not seeing it. They also concluded that less than 20% of high school students questioned false claims on social media sites. Whoa. You know, like just reading and believing everything. So issues like these go all the way up to the college level, by the way. It's not just in that age range. False information is commonly targeted at young users. You know, that in and of itself could be a long conversation. Now, check this out, guys. YouTube is what? It's one of the most popular social media sites. Yay, YouTube, right? YouTube's fun. I enjoy YouTube. Well, it was found that search terms looking for legitimate information directed users, in fact, on YouTube to misinformation. So if you use YouTube you know, it recommends videos for you after you watch something, and then a video stream will pop up and it'll show you, like, watch these, you know, check out this stuff. The problem is these recommendations typically lean the user towards more extreme and false content as it goes along. It gets more extreme and more, and, you know, it just more bullshit. So, for example, researchers tested the search term lunar eclipse. What would you guys think would show up in your YouTube if you searched on lunar eclipse?
Flat Earth, loony conspiracies.
Oh. I just want to see lunar eclipses.
Exactly.
Exactly, right, Evan? That's what I say. Yeah. But
that's
somebody
all
said it. Somebody said it. The results showed a video about flat Earth.
Ugh.
Doesn't even have anything to do with a lunar eclipse. One researcher said that YouTube is, and I quote, one of the most powerful radicalizing instruments of the 21st century. That's YouTube.
Yeah,
YouTube.
Man, optimized rabbit holes. Yep.
I'm on YouTube every day. I use it all the time.
So what's the responsibility of YouTube to make their algorithm work better in the case like that?
Evan, it is working the way they want it to.
Okay. If it's by design, then YouTube's
evil. Of course
it's
by design. Okay. This is not by accident. This is all – I mean, they put so much time and energy into fashioning the way that their algorithms work.
Yeah, this is not a whoops. This is, oh, look at this. Radicalizing videos get more views.
Yeah.
Let's do that.
Right. It's not about the fact that they – are trying to radicalize people. It's about the fact that people want to watch this. Like, this stuff compels more eyeballs.
Exactly,
it works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So look, and I'm not surprised. You know, I thought that Facebook was more of a problem than YouTube. I guess it's hard to even judge. But
I think Facebook is more of a problem for older people.
Yeah, you're right.
YouTube for younger people.
So it's good that social media is being researched. I completely agree that we should be researching social media, and we should also be researching, you know, we should quantify the effects that it has, right? We should have a better understanding of this. What do we do in social media's wake? What are we going to do about it? How do we deal with this? How do we educate people to handle what we're faced with right now? And this happens to be a very highly debated question. Bob, there is things that we can do.
Sure, but we won't.
Well, okay, that's a different thing.
That's a different question.
But this is a very highly debated question among some researchers and educators. I say some, obviously, because, you know, we're talking about a slice of all the researchers and educators out there are actually paying attention to this. But the ones that are paying attention are very much involved in it. So, well, of course, I come out of the gate and say, learning about critical thinking is key, right? Number one, it's got to be the most important thing here. You have to understand how to think and how to do the things that we talk about on this show in order to, you know, wade through the internet. Schools could teach something called media literacy, and some do. You know, the goal here is to give students mental tools to identify fake or bad information. Now, the scary thing is that some of this misinformation is coming from the parents themselves, right? It's coming from their families, who are also misinformed by fake news and social media sites.
Some of it's coming from the teachers, Jay.
I know. Like, this is a very difficult thing to talk about because of how complex it is. And I'm trying to paint the picture here so we can, you know, dig in a little bit. So all right, let me give you a few more things to think about. Schools seem to be the only place that most kids can learn about critical thinking, right? If there's any place that the average kid is going to learn about critical thinking, it's not going to be at home. It's not going to be in the ballpark. It's going to be at the school. And as most skeptics know, there are amazingly few classes that teach critical thinking. You know, some teachers who have a love and understanding of critical thinking, yeah, they'll incorporate it into their classes. But that's rare, very rare. There are some resources on the web, absolutely. Some are actually very helpful. Like, I like commonsense.org or commonsensemedia.org. If you have children and you want to know, can I show my kid this particular thing? Common Sense Media is great. Well, commonsense.org has some really good resources there. If you're curious, go check it out. But even with these resources, it's not even close to being enough. We need critical thinking inserted into the common core at the right age range. Couple stats for you. In 2021, the U.S. state of Illinois was the first to require high school students to take a media literacy class. Other states, you know, they have quote-unquote media literacy laws, but they're largely ineffective. Some, for example, require media literacy information to be put on their websites, or just the information to be made available to students, whatever the hell that means. The quality of that media literacy and And if it's even getting in front of the students, of course, is the big question mark here. Overall, universities have a better track record of teaching media literacy, but by the time students get there, it's already too late. Researchers who study issues like this typically don't agree on what should actually be taught to students learning media literacy. Some researchers believe students should focus on where the information is coming from, and others believe they should get their information from journalistic sources. The fact is that there is not a lot of data at all about what method is best here, and that is one of the core problems. There's also something called news literacy. This focuses on the spread of conspiracies and a student's ability to identify real news from fake news. This focuses on the reliability and credibility of news and online information. And again, the researchers have very different perspectives on how the skills should be taught. To sum it up here, the researchers and the educators all acknowledge that there isn't enough data to make a really science-based decision on how to move forward. What is the best method? What is the best information to teach? They don't know. Nobody knows. Everybody has their own opinions on what they think is the right way to do it. What the researchers are trying to do now is get more information. That, as you know, it takes a very long time to do it, and it costs a lot of money. The majority of the research that exists has been conducted on college students, which really doesn't help the age range that we want, which, unfortunately, that's just where the research has been conducted. Now, after being involved with critical thinking for 30 years, right, guys? 16 years co-hosting a podcast about critical thinking, co-authoring a book about critical thinking. I think that this is actually a pretty clear situation. The students should be learning a broad spectrum of critical thinking skills. This is all my opinion. It shouldn't just be about media literacy or news literacy. I mean, that's like, you know, it's too narrow. We've talked about developing a baloney detector in your mind, right? What is that baloney detector? It's actually having a foundational understanding of many critical thinking skill sets, right? That's why we wrote the book, because we had to put it all in one collection, because all of it is kind of codependent on each other. You need this foundation of critical thinking. And I also detect that the researchers are so dependent on the quote unquote data and research that they're missing the bigger picture, which is it's already out there. We already have the information. We already have the information on what students should be learning. I know that it hasn't been, you know, turned into classroom lessons and all of that. I mean, some of it is out there, and I know, you know, we haven't stitched it all together, but come on. What is the actual question? They say that they don't have enough data. I think we have the data. I think we know exactly what people need to learn.
Well, all right, but it is a reasonable point to say, do we have like scientific studies showing us that the outcomes actually work now? And that is what is lacking. That's what was most concerning to me. So first of all, I agree with you saying, does teaching media literacy work, or what method of teaching media literacy works the best, is kind of already starting with the wrong premise, because I, you know, over the year, that's like saying, how do we teach scientific literacy? It's like, does that work? Does teaching scientific literacy keep people from believing in conspiracies? It has nothing to do with how you teach scientific literacy. It's that scientific literacy by itself is not enough.
Exactly.
You need to teach scientific literacy and media literacy and critical thinking skills together. And I do think that there's evidence to back that up. I don't think we can say that their point is not correct, because they're getting more granular. They're saying, not does teaching media literacy work, but which method of teaching media literacy is better.
Right, but not having that data shouldn't preclude you
exactly.
from teaching.
Right.
I think that's
right.
the
exactly.
real question. We should be doing it anyway, and we should also be studying it.
We should be doing it and studying how to do it better.
Yeah, yes. I don't want. I hate to think that they're being hung up. You know, they're kind of like. You know,
I don't think so, Jay. I don't think that's the case. I think it's just they're. You know, at the academic level, they're like they're doing what they should be doing. They're being skeptical and they're asking questions. They're not making assumptions. That doesn't mean you do nothing in the meantime. It's just like, again, with medicine, just because we don't know what the best treatment is doesn't mean we do nothing and let the patient die.
Of course,
but you go, Steve, with the evidence you have.
With critical thinking, though, are there really like unturned stones here? Like, we do have our thumb on it. We know how to teach people critical thinking.
Yeah, but they weren't even, Jay, they weren't even talking about critical thinking. They were talking about media savvy, media literacy. And that is distinct, but they're distinct. Yes, there's overlap. There's a lot of overlap, but they are distinct.
I know, you're right.
Subsets. My problem with the whole approach was not that they were questioning, you know, which method of media literacy is most effective and what are the long-term outcomes. That's great. My problem was they didn't even challenge the premise that media literacy is the problem, and they didn't mention at all that you need to combine it with broader critical thinking skills and scientific literacy.
Right, exactly.
Right. Where's the conversation about basic philosophy and basic psychology curriculum? Like, very few students have exposure to psychology or philosophy except when they get to college, if they choose to major in it or to take those courses as part of their core curriculum. But you can get through a PhD having never taken a single psych course and a single philosophy course.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And these I think, are vehicles for teaching critical thinking.
I agree. Yep. I agree. Though I kind of, you know, in my own categorization, I include them under critical thinking. Understanding the philosophical basis of science and understanding the psychological basis of belief. That's all under the broader, which again, Jay, goes beyond media literacy, which is why it has to be noted separately.
I know that media literacy it's a subset, right? It's kind of like if we had a tree of critical thinking, like media literacy is a leaf on a branch on that tree. It's too small. It's too narrow. I think teaching people critical thinking, the foundational part of critical thinking, you know, it would give them such a boost up in so many different ways in so many different areas that, you know, the media literacy thing is just a tiny little part of this whole thing that
needs to
be out there.
I totally agree. And it's, again, I see it as the same as, you know, the 30 years ago when we were – and we fell into this. We were talking about we have to teach scientific literacy and that's the answer to pseudoscience and conspiracies. And it's like, no, it's not true. It's a tiny slice. Mm-hmm. You have to combine all three together.
Mm-hmm. There are people who have philanthropic desires, right? If we threw $1 billion at critical thinking, how would you spend that? And I would say one of the first things I would do is get a few lobbyists pushing this agenda because it's so important.
Where's Bill Gates?
This doesn't happen at the federal level. It happens at the state level. You need 50 lobbyists. Yeah. But in any case, you know, yes, it's challenging. We need to get it into the curriculum. How do you fundamentally change the curriculum? That is a hard generational battle. But the best I think we could do, like our movement could do, is to provide the resources and, you know, as much as possible to – you need to have just lifelong education, even outside the educational system, as much as we can on YouTube, on Facebook, you know, in adult learning scenarios, you know, as a movement, that's what we could do. I would like, you asked previously, how do we interface with the academics? I've been asking myself that question for 20 years. I think, unfortunately, our movement is looked on as a popular movement and not academic, and that's unfortunate.
Even though a huge percentage of us are academics.
Are academics, I know.
Yeah, I know. It's not correct.
But even, you're right, even within academic circles, it's like, oh, they do that skeptical work.
Yeah, I know.
It's not so central to the department.
I had somebody ask me the other day, just innocently, just, you know, from what they saw of me online, so you investigate ghosts? And like, oh, total facepalm.
Like, oh, fuck.
I gave them the elevator pitch on like what I actually do, but the idea that this point in my skeptical career somebody could see my online persona and boil it down to you investigate ghosts, you know, just so disappointing. I think, but that's the problem that we're dealing with, right?
Yeah.
Steve, I get you. I see you, Steve. I see you.
You see me, Jay?
I see people. I see skeptics.
God help us. All right.
It's like, no, I investigate the people who investigate ghosts, right? Yeah, as a way of teaching science and critical thinking, blah, blah, blah. But it was, we still have a lot of work to do. All right, Bob, tell us how Peter Jackson is using artificial intelligence to bring us these great old footage that he's been doing.
Yeah, well, I finally got up to speed the past few days and was transfixed by Peter Jackson's The Beatles Get Back docuseries. Wow. So impressed. So immediately, went to YouTube. I typically do that. Go right to YouTube because I want to hear commentary. What are people saying? And I came across an angle I really hadn't fully appreciated, and that's the extensive use of cutting-edge technology to make the visuals and the audio as amazing as it was in that show. So I want to discuss the tech for a bit, and maybe at the end I'll throw in a little extra, like how a critical tenet of skepticism could have potentially scuttled the entire docuseries. So, okay, we got Michael Lindsay Hogg, January 1969. He filmed the Beatles, writing the songs, or developing the songs, creating the songs for a big live recording that never happened as originally planned, but eventually culminated right in their iconic rooftop concert on London's Savile Row, their last public performance ever. Hogg created 60 hours of video footage and more than 150 hours of unheard audio. It was all created in that month of January in 69. Some of it was used for the 1970 Let It Be movie. The rest was in storage for almost as long as Jay has been alive. In
oh, my
words,
gosh.
A really, really long time.
Thanks, Bob.
Must have decayed.
Oh, my God. So then, Hugh. So recently, maybe what, like, say 4 years ago or so, Q Apple CEO Jeff Jones and director of production Jonathan Clyde, they saw Peter Jackson's pioneering 2018 restoration of that World War One documentary. You guys remember that?
Yes, they shot
that.
That
was amazing.
Yeah. Amazing. Was
awesome. Mind blowing.
So yes, what he did to that footage is, like I said, he pioneered this restoration ability like nobody else had before him. So they contacted him and said, hey, you want to apply your skills to the Beatles footage? So, and yeah. Of course, I didn't know this. Jackson is a huge fan, huge Beatles fan, crazy fan. So the first hurdle was the video itself. And this is, remember, film. This is 16 millimeter film from 1969, not in good shape. You know, I mean, at its best, you know, it's still 16 millimeters, not great. But a half a century ago, Peter and his buddy, I forget his name, they described it as being chunky and grainy. With a desaturated look to it. All the colors were washed out, not in really good shape at all. So they brought their video restoration experience from They Shall Not Grow Old to bear. And so they were able to do things like they were able to degrain it. They were able to upscale it. They were able to soften the video and other techniques to make it, it was to a dramatic degree, I think. And we've all seen that de-aging technology that on many actors in various movies. And those techniques are good. They're getting better, certainly getting really better, getting very impressive. And so what they did was kind of de-age the film in a way as well. But also, in addition to de-aging it, they made it more lifelike than it ever was. So they actually improved it beyond, I think, what it ever was. If you had watched it in February of 1969, it would not have looked anywhere near as good. It truly was impressive. Now, some people are complaining that the video has a distasteful, like, ethereal quality to it and that it's too soft. I don't know. I disagree. I think what they have accomplished, especially if you compare, if you look at it side by side, it's an amazing difference. It looks wonderful. And, I mean, I felt like I was there. It felt like a modern movie. It felt like it was made yesterday.
People were actually complaining. They were like, oh, it doesn't look like I shot it on my iPhone.
Or they're like, what's that weird thing? Maybe they see some weird optical, some fleeting optical effects that I never noticed. But there's always going to be complainers.
Jeez.
But the video restoration was actually trivial compared to the audio. In many ways, or most ways that I could think of, the original audio was far worse than the original video. And that's because, it was horrific. And that's because of two things, what I call the tyranny of mono and the guitar subterfuge. Okay. Now the tyranny of mono, I mean that the mono recording of the early rehearsals were problematic for storytelling. And that's why Peter Jackson was there. It was recorded that way because it was just rehearsals, right? You don't put rehearsals on a track. Throw the microphone in there and just record what you can. And it doesn't have to be this high resolution, awesome stuff. So it kind of makes sense. But I mean, if it's mono, that means that all the instruments, all the singing voices, all the speaking voices, they were all on one track. There was no balancing. There was no mixing, nothing. So this left many of the important conversations between the Beatles inaudible because they were just buried within all the other louder noises going on, right? You know, they're playing or whatever. They're making comments. They're talking while they're playing. And you can't make out the audio hardly at all. And there's, you know, and it's mono. You can't pull out the audio track, you know, in isolation and just listen to that. Can't do it because it's not there. Now, that, of course, would have been a major problem for Jackson, since those conversations, far less than the music, the conversations were the meat of his narrative, right? The story that he wanted to convey was in those discussions and not necessarily at nearly as much in the music itself. So on top of all that, mono, the tyranny of mono, there was the guitar subterfuge. Now, the Beatles, and especially John and George, did not like having their conversations recorded, especially some of their conversations, because they're private conversations. They've been doing this at that point for, what, 15 years, and they're used to, you know, having privacy and saying whatever they want. They agreed to the filming, but they didn't like the conversations being recorded. So Peter Jackson said the following. So what John and George used to do is, if they were in a conversation, they would turn their amps up loud and they'd strum the guitar. They'd just be strumming, not playing anything, no tune. So all Michael's microphones were recording was this loud guitar, but you'd see the Beatles talking, having some private chat. And you can't make out what they're saying.
But doesn't that sort of implicitly then imply that, like, we should not be hearing what they said because they chose for us not to hear what they said?
No, but they knew that they were being filmed.
But they didn't know that film had the capability in the future of decoding what they were saying.
Care, you're right. It absolutely does imply that. But everyone signed off.
Oh, they signed a release.
Everybody signed off on this. They saw the videos. They saw what Jackson had done, and they all signed it off. That was Paul, Ringo, and then Harrison's wife, and
Yoko Ono.
And Yoko. Yep, Yoko
okay,
for John.
Okay.
So they all signed off on it, and they even had to walk into the bathroom, I suppose, and have a private conversation. Yeah, and they even had to sign off on just starting this entire process. They of course had to sign off on that, which I will mention later.
And I think it makes sense because, you know, at the time, they, even though you could argue about whether or not they should have, they didn't really have a sense of the historical significance
of
the whole thing.
Right.
They were just musicians.
And now I think, hopefully they do. And so saying, a conversation that they might want to have kept private 50 years ago, they appreciate now should be in the public domain.
And also there are some things that were recorded that are tragically, if it did come out at that time, it could have changed everything about the breakup of the Beatles. Because at one point, you've got George talking to John, and they're saying that, you know, we could do, you know, George, if you want to just go do your own thing, make an album, go ahead, but then come back. And we'll do another album with the Beatles, you know, and then somebody else could go out and do their own thing and then come back. And when Peter Jackson told that to Paul, Paul was like, wow, if I knew that at that time, things could have been very, very different. And that was so tragic to think that things could have been very, very different. But they okayed it. They signed off on everything. So that's the important point. Of course, they had to do that. This is, you know, their material, and it was their decision, and they made it. All right. So we're talking about the guitar subterfuge. So that made it especially hard for Jackson to listen to what they were saying. You know, whether it was mono or not, these guys were hiding their conversations and were making them pretty much unretrievable at that time. So then this, of course, is where machine learning comes in and saves the day. These techniques have been improving for years. This isn't brand new technology. But what they did was essentially demix the mono recording and create multiple tracks that can be isolated from the mono using machine language. That is fantastic. Jackson said that he had his people tweak the existing technology specifically for what they needed to do. So Peter said the following. We developed a machine learning system that we taught what a guitar sounds like, what a bass sounds like, what a voice sounds like. In fact, we taught the computer what John sounds like and what Paul sounds like. So we can take these mono tracks, split up all the instruments, and we can just hear the vocals, the guitars. You see Ringo thumping the drums in the background, but you don't hear the drums at all. That allows us to remix it really cleanly.
Fantastic.
Right? So when Jackson says that we taught the computer what John sounds, he means that they fed it the training data, right? Because that's the bread and butter, or should I say, the toast and marmalade of deep learning. And I threw that comment in there for people who have watched it. How much toast did they eat and marmalade? every damn day. There's our toast, British, and there's our jelly jam marmalade, whatever the hell you want to call it. But I did want some as I was watching it. It looked kind of delicious. Okay, so this has been compared in some ways to deep fake technology. Specifically, Jason Perlow is a senior technology editor at ZDNet. He calls it deep restoration, which I kind of really like. Except it's problematic since deep, you know, it's based off of deep fakes.
Yeah, but it's like you can't do one without the other, right? Like if you're going to develop the technology to do deep restoration, it's probably a lot of overlap with deep fake.
Oh, there's tons of overlap. And my concern is the nomenclature. You don't have to call it deep restoration. I just don't. Mm. And I like the term deep restoration. I don't know if it'll take. Maybe it's already taken, but it's unfortunate that it's associated with deep fake, which is such a horrible thing in a lot of ways. Okay. So the big breakthrough for us was actually not restoring the pictures, even though that was obviously looked at. Even though that's what you obviously look at, it was the sound. So the sound for Jackson, that's what made his day with this entire project, the breakthroughs they made with the sound. For him, the video restoration was actually probably much easier than even the World War I restoration, because that video was even in worse shape. It probably was, you know, relatively easy for him, but the audio was the challenge, and they came out with some amazing stuff. So that's it for that technology. But this also is related to an interesting aside, and I'll read it. I'll say it in Peter's voice. So this is related to skepticism and memory. So in December 2017, McCartney came to New Zealand on tour and was invited backstage to discuss the project. I had an iPad, and so I went into the dressing room and shook his hand and said, "So, Paul, I've seen all the outtakes from Let It Be." I could see the nervousness on his face. I mean, he was there in 1969, but he hadn't seen the footage. And he said, "Yeah?" And I could see there was trepidation on his face. I just said, "Look, whatever you think it is, it's not what you think it is. Because I thought it was going to be miserable, but I'm amazed at how funny and happy it is. It's completely different to what I imagined." He said, "Yeah? What? Really?" He just had no realistic appreciation of Peter's appreciation of the footage, because this is 50 years ago to Paul. Peter had just seen it, and his takeaway is not what did not sync up with Paul's memory.
Well, Paul's going to remember the tone of the era. He's going to remember how he felt about his bandmates at the time, what he was, you know, he's going to have a very biased memory of what that exact snippet in time looked like. Because it's going to get lost in the larger picture.
It's more complicated than that.
Going from the first person to the third person.
Basically. No, it's more complicated. You'll see what I'm talking about. So then what Peter Jackson did, he showed him the clips on the iPad, and later he did the same for Ringo, and he convinced them that Let It Be filming was not what they thought. And so Jackson continues here. "But they had somehow imposed all their memories of the Get Back sessions from January 69 on the May 1970 release of the film, Let It Be. So Let It Be for them is a symbol of a very unhappy time that they were personally experiencing when the band was breaking up. And they transposed all of that emotional energy, that emotional memory onto the Get Back sessions, which obviously is unfair because that was 15 months earlier. I've had to sort of just gently kind of show Ringo and Paul that it's not quite how they remember it. It's not May 1970. This is January 69. So I think Peter Jackson nailed it here. This appears to be, it's an example of common to many skeptics, right? Memories change over time depending on many things. This appears to be a case of memory contamination, and definitely an unusual form of that. But that's kind of what it is, because they were taking their memories from over a year later and kind of throwing them onto the memories of January 69, you know, yeah, because
that makes perfect sense.
It makes perfect
sense.
What I was trying
to say, they're remembering the tone of an era. It was a bad time for them.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, 50 years. I mean,
January 69 wasn't, but yes, later on it was, right? And that was leaking into the 69. Mm-hmm. So now some say that Jackson is kind of suppressing or camouflaging the true tone of that January in 1969. I mean, I don't think so, based on what I've read. But I can't be sure. But I do know this. Two guys who were there. There's Michael Lindsay Hogg, who filmed it, and producer Glyn Johns, the guy who wore all those crazy, wacky, awesome clothes. Both of these guys, from the get-go, have always said that it was a wonderful January. There was some tension. Of course, there was some tension. You know, people quit bands all the time. He's like, I see that all the time. They quit for a month. They quit for a month or a few days and they come back. It happens all the time. No big deal. It was a wonderful month. And producer Glyn Johns had a, his specific quote is, he said, I don't know why people have this thought about the Get Back sessions. I was there and I was laughing all day long every day. So these two guys have been saying they have not been contaminated by the slow morph of people's memories of January 1969. They were like, it was an awesome time. We had a blast and look what we accomplished. But everyone's memories over the decades have been kind of morphing into this like, oh, it was such a depressor. It was such a downer. And, you know, and they broke up. But it's really, you know, it seems like it's reasonable that it's a contamination from that Let It Be, the Let It Be video, which was played during a bad time, you know?
Right.
But it wasn't bad when the footage was filmed. And that's why it's so fascinating that this video footage has revealed this, that, you know, and even Paul was like skittish and scared. And he, you know, he may have just deep sixed this whole project. If Peter didn't convince him, like, no, this footage is inspiring in a lot of ways. And it's hilarious. And John Lennon, how funny was that bastard? I was laughing at him so much. He's so funny. Such an amazing guy. Just all of them were. But Paul and John, of course, were just real standouts for me. Oh my God. So, but the technology, you know, as awesome as it was, the technology behind it made it all possible.
And that's what I love about this technology. It really is bringing past points in history to life. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm still amazed at the World War One documentary.
Ugh, yeah.
They Shall Not Grow Old. Because, you know, and you don't realize how like ingrained in you the weird timing of the footage.
Yeah.
And, like they move, everyone's moving, you know.
Yeah, because it's like, it's not in sync with our
it's
eyes.
Not in sync.
And, yeah.
And then, yeah, that makes it seem so unreal. Mm-hmm. And then just having them, you know, move naturally. Is like suddenly, oh my God, these are
actual people.
Yeah. People. Yeah. They're people. That was a guy that was there doing that at that time. He was just you know, it makes it feel like it's today. It was really transporting.
Oh, you know, and the fact that he gave them a voice, remember? He actually hired voice actors to speak for them and in the same dialects that they would have had depending on where they were from the UK.
My God.
Like, he did all this work. And I think the thing that, you know, that exactly what you're saying, Steve, about they came to life. One of the big things for me that made them come to life is you saw how young they were. They never look young when they're black and white.
But
the
right.
minute, the minute that they came to life where the camera speed and everything was like timed to be more modern, you're like, oh my God, they were children.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And around 30.
I felt the same way about Get Back. I mean, these guys were, they're, you know, musical geniuses and they're like 25. 26,
28,
28 some of them. There was a span, 25 to 28. Yeah. I think 24 to 28, actually. That is mind-blowing because, you know, I was like in my mom's basement in my mid-20s. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I'm such a loser.
Carrie, you know, I auditioned to be a voice actor for that film.
Are you serious?
What?
No.
As Ringo?
Kidding. Yeah, what would I say?
I'm like, whatever, you could audition. Doesn't mean you would get the part.
How you doing, Gavin? You know, I mean, like...
This is Jay Novella.
You know, at least one guy Beatles. In that movie talked like that.
Yeah. One thing that movie showed me was that everybody had bad teeth back then.
Well, I was going to say, that gave me an appreciation for modern dentistry. Yes.
Fuck yes. No. Yikes.
No, seriously, it was like, oh my goodness.
I mean, what the halitosis
did you
like
see George's hair? I mean, he didn't have hair. Hair had him.
Yeah.
Well, there. You know.
They're all, you know, just, like we said before, they were all geniuses and they were all in their prime during those years right there. I mean, it was an irreplaceable you can't duplicate that. I highly doubt there will ever be a band that does what they did.
No,
it's a perfect storm that is like historically unique. It'd be hard to imagine that happening again.
And, you know, watching the creative process and the birth of songs like Get Back is just like, wow, that's an amazing find.
Let It Be.
Yeah, that as well. Multiple songs, but
when Paul McCartney sits down and just starts playing Let It Be, like, holy crap.
Yeah. Historic.
And I really appreciate, you know, Peter Jackson.
Well, I wonder what's next.
Yes, what other projects?
Anything come up in your research about is there any projects on the horizon?
Star Trek, the original series, all the outtakes.
Really. You mean in terms of Jackson and the Beatles or Jackson and some other hidden footage?
No, yeah, Jackson, this technology. What's the next project?
Yeah, what are you going to apply it to?
Oh, I didn't come across anything other than just Beatles, Beatles, Beatles. So I don't know what else he's going to do in terms of restoration. If anything, I mean, I'm sure, you know, he loves it, but what else? You know, he's got a lot of irons in the fire.
Out there. Look, thank God that Disney didn't give this Beatles documentary to J.J. Abrams. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, you've had more light flares, that's for sure.
That's right.
All right, well, let's end with some good news, Evan. You're going to tell us about an exciting advance in forensic science.
That's right. You guys ready for the hard science part of the show? All right. Have you ever heard of a device called the Human Remains Locator? Neither is anyone else.
The HRL, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the HRL.
Zombie detector.
And the new model HRL, yeah. And the HRL2 is right around the corner. Stay tuned for that one. Nobody's heard of this thing. That didn't stop the NBC affiliate in Knoxville, Tennessee, though, from running a news report on a local inventor who claims to have created a device that will revolutionize the way investigators uncover human remains. So let me describe the device for you. Picture in your mind, if you will, a thin stick from the branch of a tree, about half a meter in length, but it's metal, okay? And there are three pairs of little twigs branching off, symmetrical, three tiny little twigs per side. That's the human remains locator. That's it. That's the whole device. It's a twig. It's metal, but it looks like a twig. So think about that. It's metal, but it's a symmetrical twig. That's about as good as I can describe it on an audio podcast. The inventor's name is Art Bohannon. He is a forensic investigator, and he showed off his device for the NBC news cameras. And NBC decided to allow about 5 seconds of actual footage of the device being used in their 2-minute-long news report. But thank goodness for the pause button, where I could get kind of a decent view of it and try to describe it as best as I could. Now, in those 5 seconds, you can see Bohannon using the device by holding the metal branch in one hand, palm up with his thumb on the end of the device. Sort of the classic 90-degree bend in the coat hanger wire, if you can picture that. And the device dangles loosely while the branch is held a few inches off of the ground. And he claims the device swings when it's held over a piece of land containing human bones.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, sounds a little bit familiar, right? He demonstrated his human remains locator at a early 19th century cemetery in Knoxville. And the specific claim was this. This device can find unmarked graves. And the remains, therefore. Right.
Okay. And what's the probability of there being remains?
Remains in a grave.
In an old cemetery.
Now, Steve.
You and your logic.
What are the odds?
Oh, gosh. The inventor, Bohannon, says, "I feel like Alexander Graham Bell when he had two tin cans on a string. We have proved it," it being his device. "We have proved it works." Okay, well, how does it work? Well, according to the dowser, forensic investigator, the human remains locator uses technology similar to how dowsing rods are meant to work.
Oh, they actually admit that?
Absolutely admits
oh,
it.
Oh, damn.
Yep. Responding with swinging oscillations whenever it's pointed in the direction of an unmarked grave. Uh-huh. So if you're just watching the NBC clip on this, on the news, they jump cut. I mean, they literally jump cut right off the dowsing rod, and they move on to Bohannon, the same man, and his other amazing invention. Now, this one didn't have a name to it, a cool name, but it's an orb that hangs from a fishing line, which Bohannon holds in one hand using the tips of his finger to, once again, dangle the orb at the end of the fishing line. This device helps him determine whether remains are male or female.
What?
If the orb moves clockwise, the remains are female. If it moves counterclockwise, they're male.
That's like the thing they hold over the pregnant lady's belly.
Yes, exactly. Oh.
Does that have a name? Is that also a dowsing rod? Or it's like a dowsing string?
Dowser. Yeah, it's basically another form of dowsing. Yeah, basically. And the size of the circular movement helps determine the age of the remains. So the bigger the circle, the older the remains, apparently. Which, you know, what? Mm-hmm. And what's the mechanism, by the way? How does this thing work? Well, here's the quote. "It's picking up energy from the ground. Supposedly,
energy, of course,
yeah. There's an electric field associated with bone that gets picked up by the dowsing rod. I mean, the human remains detector. Now, this intrepid team at Knoxville NBC, they managed to find another dowser, this fellow named Arpad Vaas, or Dr. Vaas. I'll come back to I'll explain who he is in just a moment. But he claims, well, he's a scientist, he's a forensic anthropologist, and also an inventor of his own human remains location device, which he calls the quantum oscillator.
Oh, no.
Oh, of course.
So we have dueling dowsers all in one report. I love it. His quantum oscillator works by placing... Here's what you do with this one. You place someone's DNA, you know, a tooth or a lock of hair, for example, inside a frequency blocking chamber in the base of the device. With the help of the technology inside this black box, it uses frequency waves to probe the environment around to find a match. And not only that, his device works over very great distances, up to 75 miles.
Oh.
And it's not just good for finding human remains. It can find all sorts of things.
Why
it
not?
Could be gold. It could be a dinosaur bone or whatever I happen to be looking for at the moment, he is quoted as saying.
Oh, you don't even have to tell it what to look for? It just kind
of... As long as you have a piece of the thing that it's looking for, you stick that in there. Silver, whatever. Right. You know, ibuprofen. It'll point to the ibuprofen 75 miles away. He says, for all the doubters out there, well, they can doubt all they want. I mean, go get a patent and see how hard that is. That was his defense to the skeptics.
You can get a patent for anything. It doesn't have to work.
Hey, look, I'm just telling you what his defense is. He says this has the potential to revolutionize forensic science.
In 1840.
Yep. They're using each of these forensic scientists are using their tools to help investigators find missing people. Right. All part of the – look, they qualify it, though. They say, hey, nothing works 100% all the time, but you need to have a fallback, and that's what these devices are meant to do. So you see what he does there in that sentence? He basically gives, like, the trapdoor out, but in a way reverses it, saying other things are not 100%, but when you can't count on those, count on us and our dowsing rods, essentially.
See, this guy is brilliant because he knows that police – departments are going to buy this stupid thing.
Oh, and they do. Oh. And they absolutely do. Plenty of stories about how they have been called in by authorities, police, FBI, and others. And of course, we know this as, you know, for skeptics and all our work that we used to do with James Randi, the James Randi Educational Foundation, and the head bang against the wall that he used to do with the FBI, with CIA, with law enforcement when it came to all these kind of crank devices. And he showed them how basically useless they are, but that didn't stop them from making big investments of taxpayer money into these pieces of garbage that have no basis in science whatsoever.
What year is it? It makes me so sad.
Exactly. Oh, and this fellow Voss, you know how long he's been around doing this for decades. In fact, when I did some research on him, there are comments about him and his various types of tools that he's been promoting since the early 2000s. So he's been around at least for two decades. At least his presence online has been trying to sell this product. This is just the latest version of his product that he has at his website, which is available. And of course, you know, there's plenty of people out there calling him a dangerous crank, frankly. You know, and
fair.
Yeah.
It's a fair cop.
Yeah.
Yep. Totally.
Absolutely. So, yep. You dowsing alive and well and the media eating it up. Not a bit of skepticism about it all. And that's where we are in this world.
All right, thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. You remember in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory when they go sit on that vehicle and he's pouring soda into it?
Yeah.
And then they get like squeeze dried. That's what it kind of reminded me of.
Oh, right. The original Willy Wonka, you said Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which was the Johnny Depp horror.
Yeah, no. I don't talk about that.
Yeah, right. It doesn't exist. But the original, yes, I do remember the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. And that scene specifically, absolutely.
So a listener named William Steele. William Steele. Very cool name. He said, "Hi, Jay. I think this week's noisy is a fishing rod reel unravel. Trying to be more specific, the recording sounds very close to the reel and potentially in a swamp at night." That is not correct, but he was the first person to write in about the fishing rod, and a lot of people wrote in about the fishing rod reel. So apparently there are fishing rods that sound like that out there in the world that nobody knew about except them. Next listener wrote in and said, "Jack," his name is Jack Davis, and he said, "Hi, Jay, you are broadcasting this on my birthday, so I thought I better guess. I think this noisy is a Geiger counter being moved over a radioactive source." Oh, that's, I thought that
I like
was
that.
A good guess. Yes, definitely. I definitely can hear Geiger counter in that. It's not correct, but definitely some of those sounds are in there.
Happy birthday.
The next listener gave the name as Honk Pilled. I don't think that's their name. He said, "Hello,
that's
Jay."
Their name.
Oh, and then he says, "My name is Damien." Okay. there is a name field, my friend. His name is Damien, and I think this noisy sounds a lot like a zip line or some other type of cabled pulley system. He says he loves the show. He's absolutely addicted. So this is not a cable, and it's not a pulley system. And I've never been on a, you know, one of those super modern, super fast zip lines, so I don't know what they sound like. Has any of you guys done that?
Mm-hmm. I've never done a zipline, no.
What?
Do they sound
fun.
Like that?
Not
I want to do
no,
it.
No, they don't sound anything like that.
Okay, so that, apparently that's not a good guess. But thank you for sending that in. The winner for last week, Jonas Fernbach. He said, "Hi, Jay. This week's noisy sounds to me like the atmospheric static buildup of electricity, which sometimes can be heard prior to a lightning strike." So he says, in short, if you're ever in a mountain and hear that sound, get down fast. So this is the sound that was recorded on a mountain as a lightning strike was about to take place. Now listen to it again.
That is scary as shit.
Yes, it is. That is that makes the hair stand up a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Especially when you know what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Electrons.
Yeah, but it, you know,
you're
like
about
you could
to get fried.
You could hear, like, I don't know the physics behind the whole thing, but there is, you know, something that is about to be released, right?
It's it has a sizzle to it.
Yeah.
Or like a buildup. Yeah, it's like a buildup of energy, like a rubber band that's about to snap.
Oh.
So we had a winner, which is fantastic. I love that. So thank you, Jonas, for sending that in. I have a new noisy for you guys this week. The noisy was sent in by a listener named G. Sterminator.
No.
Yes, G. Sterminator. G. Sterminator. Is that something I should know? I don't know.
It's just amazing. This person's name is Sterminator.
Yeah, I love it. All right, so this person sent in the following noisy. That is the sound that you must guess. So, guys, if you think you know what that is, or if you heard something cool this week, do me a favor. Just take the moment right now and send me that information at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, guess what time it is right now?
10 o'clock.
If you live in New York City or Boston, what time is it?
It is extravaganza time.
It's extravaganza time. Yeah,
extravaganza
so we booked two new extravaganzas. Just so you know, we are also booking private shows in both cities, New York City and Boston. The dates are on March 26th, we will be in New York City, and on March 27th, we will be in Boston doing the extravaganza. If you're interested, you can go to theskepticsguide.org/extravaganza. And that'll give you the two dates. And then, you know, hopefully by the time that you get this, the other dates will be up there. But if not, it'll be next week. Okay, that's number one. Number two, some of you I have found out recently don't know that the SGU has a store. Well, we do. And you can go to our store at shop.theskepticsguide.org. Please go take a look. If there's anything that you would like to see in that store, let me know. Like many of you have said, "Jay, what's up with these awesome trucker hats?" I'm working on it. I have two samples being shipped to me right now. They're coming, and I will let you know. I'm going to be very picky about this. I'm very, very picky about our swag. The hats are going to be amazing once I finally do it, but we're not ready yet, but they're coming. If you would like to support this show, you can go to our Patreon. That's patreon.com/skepticsguide. We absolutely appreciate any patronage that we get, and we definitely can use your support. So please do help us if you can. And one other thing that you can do, because lots of people are cash poor right now, you can give us a rating on whatever podcast player you're using. So please do think about giving us a rating, because it helps us, helps other people find us, which is important.
Thanks, Jay. All right, we got a couple of emails this week. The first one is a correction from last week. Jay, you gave us an update on the controversy about using 5G and its potential effects on airplane instrumentation. But there is a little bit of more nuance to this. So tell us what the difference is.
Yeah, so they're not talking about the altimeters that are found on the actual airplane. They're talking about the altimeters that are being used at the airports. And that's what instrument would be affected by the 5G. Now, I'm also reading, as this continues to unfold, that experts are chiming in and they're saying that they do not believe that there will be any interference with 5G and the altimeter instrumentation. You know, there's lots of information coming in around the world from all the different countries that have implemented it. And even though there is like some frequency differences, at its core, they're saying that it's not going to be an issue. It really was a safety concern. And apparently that there wasn't hard and fast evidence that was showing, I guess, that there was going to definitely be interference. So that's basically it. You know, I was confused about whether or not the instrumentation was on the plane or if it was ground-based. I assumed it was on the plane, because they said that planes would have to be landing with VFR, which means with visual cues and not instrumentation. So I figured it was the plane's equipment that wasn't going to be functioning, which I
– Yeah, but that's not true. The plane's altimeter will not be affected by 5G, only the towers.
Okay. And even then, they're not sure that's not going to happen.
Okay, thanks. All right, so we got a question. This is John in the UK, and John – Right. What prompted me to write, I'm going to skip through the email because it's rather long, just get to the meaty parts. John writes, what has prompted me to write is the discussion of the impact of climate change you had in your 2021 review show, where you all agreed on the dire consequences for humanity that it will inevitably bring, with one person suggesting it could wipe out human civilization and you referencing 650 million climate refugees. It crystallized in my mind a concern I've had for a while that on this topic, your discussions fall below your usual high standards of rigorous skepticism. My impression is that because you are rightly convinced on the evidence for human-induced climate change and understandably frustrated by the fools who deny that fact, you have a strong preference for evidence that climate change is going to be important to the future, and so don't seem to question modeling of its impacts as much as you would modeling on other topics. Skipping ahead, it says, for example, the most basic observation of the impact of warming over the past few thousand years is it seems to have brought some material benefits to humans as a species. I was born and raised in Northern Ireland, which at the last glacial maximum was under a mile of ice. Warming since then has turned it into fertile farming land where people thrive in a temperate climate. There's no reason why the same can't happen for swaths of Canada and Siberia in the coming decades. More generally, temporary periods where the gradual warming trend of the last 10,000 years reversed have seemed to create reversals in economic growth for the people they've affected. I believe the little ice age that affected Europe in the early 1300s provides an example of this. We also talked about carbon in the deep past. So I wanted to talk about this one because this is a common talking point among climate science deniers. And again, I don't think John is being a climate denier. I think he's just, you know, misinterpreting this. You know, he's falling for essentially this talking point, not realizing that that's exactly what it is. And the, you know, the arguments may sound superficially compelling, but when you delve a little bit deeper, it becomes obvious that the logic is not sound. So the idea is, remember, so, you know, climate deniers often use the Mott and Bailey defense, where they will deny different levels of anthropogenic global warming. They might say at one time, oh, see, global warming isn't happening. And then when, you know, presented with you know, ironclad evidence that it is, they'll say, well, it's warming, but it's not human man-made. It's a natural cycle. And then when presented with evidence that it is, they might say, well, it's, yeah, okay, it's man, you know, we're causing the warming, but it's not going to be a bad thing.
Goalpost right? shifting.
Yeah. So this is sort of that level where you're saying, all right, you it's clear that the world is warming and, you know, humans are contributing to that, but maybe this could be a good thing. You know, it ended the last ice age and, you know, there's nothing perfect. Another sort of corollary to this is there's nothing perfect about our climate that we have to preserve it exactly in its pristine state. You know, the world's, the climates have been all over the place historically, and that's going to keep happening. The climate's going to change.
Right, but it's also committing the fallacy of saying what's happening now is comparable to anything that's happened in the past, that the pace is comparable, the extent is comparable, which it's not.
It's the short span that makes this drastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's two things, I think, that render these arguments not valid. One is it's the time course of the change. It's not that, yes, the climate's been dramatically different at different times in the past. But what's really different, you know, based upon the best evidence that we have, it seems that this rapidity of the climate change is unprecedented in whatever that we can detect in the last
Like we can adapt to things
years.
That happen over.
It's an adaptation, right.
Over what do you call it, geologic time scale. It's much harder to do it over generational time scales.
Correct.
The other, I think, really core problem with or like unstated major premise here that, you know, what John is conveying is that there's an objectively good or bad climate. That's kind of a straw man.
Right.
The idea isn't that the climate has to be what it is now. It's that we're rapidly changing it and there's something different now that has never been the case previously on the Earth, you know, prior to a few hundred years ago. And that is that we have erected an elaborate civilization around our current climate. Mm-hmm. You know, we have built our cities on existing coastlines. We are farming pretty much all the arable land in order to produce enough food to feed our population.
Right. We're about to lose some of it. Yep.
Yeah. If those agricultural sweet spots start shifting north or south, depending on what hemisphere you're in, start shifting away from the equator, it's not like we can instantly adapt to that. That means we're going to have to be converting new land, new ecosystems to farmland, for example. We're just going to, what are we going to do, just move our cities inland? I mean, that's what we say, that it's not that we're going to die. And this is where I think there's a legitimate point to this, is that, and sometimes if we get lazy, we may say things too that could be overinterpreted. I do think we have to be very careful not to overstate the case technically, because the deniers will jump on that to say that we're not being scientific.
Right, that we're being climate, quote, alarmists.
Alarmists, right. So like I never say anything like we're all going to die.
No, this is an existential,
you know, going to be the end of civilization. Well, I mean, I think that saying it's an existential threat is complicated, and because it lends itself to misinterpretation. Because I don't think that the evidence makes a strong case for this is going to lead to the end of humanity. That may be a worst case scenario, but I don't see that there's, you know, that's the reasonable extrapolation of what.
Oh, rich people gonna live through this.
Oh yeah. I mean, I think people with resources, you don't have to even be rich. I just think people, the I always think of that quote from Titanic when the person says half the people on this ship are gonna die. Not the better half. The rich aristocrat is like totally full of the villain you want to hate. Yep. Not the better half. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's gonna die. You know, a good chunk of people are gonna be displaced.
Right? Just the people already struggling.
Not the well off. Not the well resourced half. Certainly,
right.
But in any case. It's going to hit everybody though, but it's going to hit the, you know, developing countries 10 times harder. The thing is, you can't just move a city inland. And will we adapt to it? Sure, but it's going to cost trillions of dollars and it's going to displace a lot of people. There's going to be climate refugees, which is going to cause political havoc, and it's going to cost trillions of dollars. But we will adapt to it. We will have no choice but to do that. People
will plan it.
But even beyond that, I do think it's important. I mean, we don't want to sweep under the rug the actual existential threat, or even I could say eschatological threat, that lots of species are going to die and are dying already.
Totally.
The oceans are in so
this
much
is another, this is another separate question, but it is tied up with this, is are we in the middle of a mass extinction?
Right, the sixth
extinction, depends.
Right?
It depends on how you define, quote-unquote, mass extinction. We're certainly experiencing an increased extinction rate above the background. Mm-hmm. There is a legitimate scientific question as to how much.
Right.
But the real concern is that even if it's not that dramatic right now, there's a range of opinions, and at the upper end of that range, it is dramatically increased now. But even if it's only at the modest end of the range, it's not a question of today. It's a question of 1,000 years from now or 2,000 years from now, which is a geological blink of an eye, but we are setting the stage for a mass extinction for basically habitat loss, climate change, et cetera, for all loss of biodiversity. When species biodiversity declines below a certain rate, they're like almost certain to go extinct in the next 2,000 years.
And you add to that, Steve, that the negative feedback loop, this like runaway process, that the consensus is in on that. We know that it's not as bad as it's going to be because the actions that have taken place up to this point have yet to play out in the climate.
Yeah, that's right. And again, it may be 100 or 200 years before we see like the real catastrophic, sea level change, et cetera, but yeah, we're setting the stage for unavoidable, like inevitable consequences down the road. And multiple teams of economists have crunched the numbers and conservatively come up with, by the end of this century, climate change is going to cost the world trillions and trillions of dollars. And therefore, even if we spend billions of dollars to try to mitigate it, that will be paid off 1,000-fold in the future. But this gets back to what we were talking about before about, it's hard to get people to spend money now for that future generations could save it later or to deal with things that are really slowly evolving in the background and not like right in our face. There is a point that we have to be careful not to overstate what we're saying or give the wrong idea. But I think the consensus is, and then he came back, I emailed this to him and John came back and said, but there's uncertainty in the models. Like, of course, there's uncertainty. The point is, how certain do we need to be in order to make common sense changes that are probably, even if it's not certainly, going to save us a lot of headache in the future? Again, I like to take a medical approach and say, if the doctor told you, all right, listen, you got a mass in your liver, but all of our techniques are not perfect, and there's a lot of uncertainty as to whether or not this is cancer. So should we do nothing about it and see what happens, or do you want to do a biopsy now, even though I can't be sure that it is cancer? You know what I mean? Like, there's sometimes you have to make decisions with uncertainty and with imperfect information because time is your enemy.
Right.
Because you have to act now.
It's too late.
Because if you don't, not only it becomes quote unquote too late, or it just becomes harder and harder and harder to treat the more time you let go by. And so it's like the asteroid thing. I mean, there's only a 50% chance it's going to hit the Earth, but our models are really imperfect. Do you really trust the models? I trust them enough to deflect that asteroid.
Right. And you add to that even those analogies aren't perfect because the error bars are both on the side of bad crap happening. Like, there's no model that says everything going to be okay. You know what
right.
I mean?
That's
the models are really like, how bad is it going to be?
Even if you take the two standard deviations, which is like a reasonable approach to things like this, there's a range of outcomes. But if you take the two standard deviations, it's all bad.
Yeah.
It doesn't cross over the line of, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, there's no point where the asteroid doesn't hit us in this model. Like, the climate still warms and we still have downstream effects of it. It's just how bad are they? I don't want to gamble on that.
Yep. Jor-El tried to convince the politicians on Krypton.
Look how that turned out.
That their
right?
planet was going to explode. They would not listen to him. And they're like, guess what happened?
Thanks for the question, John.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, that I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. 3 regular news items this week. You guys ready?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Item number 1. Researchers report they were able to successfully regrow a functional leg in a rat following treatment with a 5-drug cocktail. Number two, a new study of the neuroanatomy of bat hearing finds that bats fall into two groups with distinct anatomy for echolocation, suggesting that echolocation may have evolved independently in the two groups. And on number three, scientists report the first successful laparoscopic operations, specifically intestine repair, performed entirely by a surgical robot without any human control. Kara, you haven't gone first in a while.
I have not. All right. So, regrow a functional leg in a rat following a treatment with a five. So, just drugs, just a chemical change, which I assume would like really boost some trophic factors, or maybe even almost like a cancer drug, or actually the opposite of a cancer drug, something that like increased cell division. Although, I think that rat would then be just like full of tumors. I don't know. This one seems kind of far-fetched. A whole leg? In a mammal? Yeef. Okay. Neuroanatomy of bat hearing. Bats fall into two groups with distinct anatomy for echolocation, suggesting that it may have evolved independently. Pfft, why not? I mean, convergent evolution happens all the freaking time. And the first successful laparoscopic operation, specifically intestine repair, performed entirely by the robot. But, and I think the caveat here is without any human control, so no joysticking, no computer inputs at all.
None. Entirely on their own.
I think that it could happen. Why not? I do think it could happen. I think especially if they really, really mapped the crap out of it in advance. Like they had a ton of imaging in advance and they were really able to rehearse and map this thing out and then have the robot actually perform it. I think it could happen. So yeah, I think it's the leg, a rat leg just completely regrown. Like that's a lot of really amazing science that would have to go into that. And that has massive implications for human medicine. So I think it might be a little too good to be true. I'm going to call that the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Let's see. Start with three. Robotic laparoscopic operation. I watch a lot of medical shows with mom. And intestinal repair. Now, Kara, you were right. Without any human control is impressive. But intestinal repair is also mighty, mighty impressive. That's very tough to repair for even a human. I hope that's true. That's really cool. Let's see. The echolocation. Yeah, convergent evolution. Let's see. We'll go to one. Growing a leg in a rat, a mammal, that's what's getting me on this one. That's just too awesome. I'll say that's fiction.
Okay, Jay.
Yeah, you know, I'm just going to cut right to it. I think the growing the animal limb with chemicals, I just don't think that's real. That's got to be the fiction.
And Evan?
Well, I suppose concerning the rat, if they were able to regrow that functional leg, it would have gotten back in the rat race.
Hi-o.
So hi-o. That's all I have to say about that. Following a tree. Functional leg, huh? Yeah, that seems, a little far-fetched there. But these other ones, you know, the bat one, neuroanatomy of the bat, two groups, distinct anatomy for echolocation. Yeah, sure, why not? Oh, gosh, the only other one it could be is the one with the intestine repair. No human control whatsoever. Oh, gosh. I don't know. Do I buck the trend?
Prometheus, baby.
I will. Okay. Sandwiches. Guys, I'll stick with the team. I will go with the rat leg. We're all in the same boat now. Steve's going to sweep us or we're going to sweep him.
Okay. Fine. So you guys all seem to have the easiest time with number two. So we'll start there. A new study of the neuroanatomy of bat hearing finds that bats fall into two groups with distinct anatomy for echolocation, suggesting that echolocation may have evolved independently in the two groups. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yeah.
This is pretty cool.
Yeah,
so yeah, that is pretty slick.
There are the two main groups of bats are
fruit bats?
Are literally called yin and yang. You know, they're
yin nice.
Yeah, so Yinterochiroptera and Yangochiroptera. So they use different methods of echolocation, and this is the first time, which has been known previously, but now the new study was looking at the neuroanatomy and showing that that is also different and kind of makes sense once you know what the difference is. So the yang bats are the more common type of the echolocating bat, and they use a variable frequency noise to echolocate, whereas the yin bats use a steady frequency.
Ooh, pretty fundamental difference.
Well, it's pretty different. So what they found was that the Yang bats have a spiral ganglion, you know, where the hearing cells are, is essentially open with lots of nerves coming off of the spiral ganglion. And that allows for a lot greater possibility for anatomy, which they think, and anatomical variation, which they think may be the reason why there are so many more Yang bats, because it just allowed for this adaptive radiation much more freely. Whereas the Yin bats have a closed bony surrounding, which is similar to all other mammals, right? So the Yin bats are like every other mammal in that in the anatomy of their inner ear, and that may be why they're more narrow. There aren't as many of them because they don't have as much freedom to experiment anatomically. So they have there's like a few holes through which the nerves go from the spiral ganglion, but the open pattern, it just allows for a lot more variability in the anatomy. So that means, because they're so fundamentally different anatomically, these are distinct groups. So the two possibilities are, I mean, the simplest possibility is that they just evolved independently. But we can't say that's the only possibility, because it is possible that they share a common ancestor, which is no longer alive. Like whatever group that what they had in common is no longer represented in either the fossil record or in extant species. And so they look like two separate groups, but really they're connected anyway. Yeah, but I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Let's go back to number one. Researchers report they were able to successfully regrow a functional leg in a rat following treatment with a 5-drug cocktail. You all think this one is fiction. Let me ask you a question. What would you say if I had instead made this regrow a functional leg in a frog, let's say?
Much more reasonable.
Would you buy it?
Than a mammal, yes.
Well, compared to the other two, I still might not, but
I don't think maybe. I'd buy it.
In an amphibian, if you had used a straight reptile, probably.
So this one is the fiction.
Yes!
But because they did do it in a frog.
Oh,
so I changed
cool.
it to a rat.
Oh,
which cool. is nice.
Yeah, you might have gotten me with a frog.
Yeah, you know, it's always a question of which one to make the fiction. I mean, mammal is like, that's
leaps and bounds.
Totally different ballpark. So yeah. you've focused in on that correctly. But frogs, not adult frogs, but, you know, tadpoles can regenerate. A lot of, reptiles can, lizards. So there are groups, but not mammals. So it would be a much, much bigger deal if this
And would have huge medical implications.
Yeah,
huge.
but the hope is that it still will, Kara. Mm-hmm. It's just a few steps removed. You know,
right.
We just have to, now that we can do it in an adult frog, which they can't do without the drug treatments. And that is, it was a 5-drug cocktail. They basically cut off their leg. They put this like little cast on with this 5-drug cocktail on the end of the severed limb for a day, only 24 hours. And then over the next few weeks, they regrew a leg. And it was able to function. I don't think it was perfect, but it was. You know, they said it was a functional leg. Hmm. But yeah, not in a.
Yeah, it could swim. I think it was the bone. The toes were missing some bones.
Yeah, it wasn't.
But
perfect,
otherwise, but it was mostly there, and it was functional as a swimming leg. And it was exciting. It's an exciting advancement.
Yeah, definitely. Just not a rat.
But a rat would be much better.
Not a mammal. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
And this means that this was the real gotcha. And none of you, Evan, almost got you on it, Evan. Scientists report the first successful laparoscopic operations. I say operations because there were four. They did this four times.
Oh, geez.
Specifically, intestine repair, which is a very tricky surgery, performed entirely by a surgical robot without any human control. That is science. The thing I left out is that this was done in pigs.
Oh.
Of course it was, because
they're not going to do that in a person the first time. Yeah,
you're not going to do it. Yeah, you're not going to start on people. You're going to start on an animal. So this was done in pigs. But the robot actually did better than a human surgeon at repairing an intestine.
Really?
That's absolutely.
That's awesome. Like,
better?
No, I want the robot to suture me.
Totally.
Yeah, right.
So wait, did it make decisions? Or
yes,
was it all completely pre-planned?
No.
Oh, I was envisioning a situation where it was so rehearsed.
And I didn't want to correct you because it would have made it seem like I was pushing you in the direction. But the software, that's the whole point. Is that because you can't map out a surgery like this from beginning to end and then just blindly follow a procedure.
It's soft tissue.
You've got to make decisions as you go. And so that's why you always have the human intervention to try to make the top level decisions about how to proceed with the surgery, depending on how things are going.
Mm-hmm.
But the software here was able to do it. It was able to make decisions about how to proceed, to visualize the intestines, what it was doing and to pull it all together. And what this was anastomosing, or connecting together two ends of the intestine, right, so that they have a good tight seal. They don't leak, and they have blood supply, and it's all good. Now, they said that this is like the purpose of this, like why would we want to have this? Why not just let people do it? Even if it's just as good as the best surgeon, let's say not better, but this was like in fact could be even better because the robot just had such precision and also consistency and accuracy that you just can't. It's hard to get with a human operator. But this would democratize, is the term that they use, this kind of surgical procedure. You're no longer basically at the mercy of whoever, whatever the surgical skill of the surgeon that happens to be in your area.
Or how much coffee they drank that morning.
Yeah, or how much money you have to pay for like a high-end surgeon. If you live in a rural area that's underserved and you don't have to make do with what surgical skill is available, or if you're in a poor country or whatever, that if you have a robot that could do a perfect job, essentially.
With the robot,
can it handle an emergency? Can it handle a curveball?
Within reason, sure.
You're going beyond the research now, so I don't know what the answer to that is, to be honest with you. It did what it did. It was able to plan out and perform this surgery, not just carry out a rote set of movements, but to actually design its way through the procedure. Very impressive. And the fact that the results were so good, it's going to be, I don't know, how long will it take before this gets approved to do it on a person?
Yeah. How many times do you think it needs to do this surgery and do exactly what Jay said, like handle emergency situations during the surgery?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the next step is going to be, or if they did human cadavers already. That's another sort of surgical tool that surgeons use to develop. A lot of surgical techniques are developed on cadavers. A lot are also developed on animals, dogs or pigs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then once you perfect it, like I always remember watching this documentary about like one of the first like cardiac transplants, and the guy said, my first 14 patients died. The 15th was a success. Of course, the first 14 were dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So that's why they not until the first 13 were dogs. And then once you perfected it, then you do it on people. This is like Prometheus, where they had like the surgeon in a box, basically. They do the robotic surgery. You go into the chamber and the arms come out and do whatever the surgery is. It's completely plausible, and we certainly have the robotic technology to do it, and now we have the AI technology to do it too.
Yeah, and we already are doing a lot of robotic, like assisted, like hybrid surgeries for sure. Like hybrid. That's a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's interesting. They say they grade a robotic surgery based on LOA, level of autonomy. Mm-hmm. And that ranges from pure teleoperation, where a surgeon is 100% in control of what the robot's doing, all the way to pure autonomy, full autonomy. So this is the first to go all the way to full autonomy.
That's
cool. All right, baby, that's sweet.
Right. And I'm sure for a while there's going to need to be human surgeons there. Obviously, there's still a role for surgeons are also they are doctors, they are decision makers, they are deciding who and when gets the surgery and when to use different techniques. So this will just be one more technique or tool that surgeons will use. This isn't going to replace human surgeons.
Right. There's not going to be like no one in the room.
Could
that
you
would
imagine?
Be scary.
Like the as much as I am totally into the technology and appreciate it and think it's amazing, this is a very semi-unsettling thing.
It is a little bit. Just
I think
emotionally,
it's
like having
not at all.
The robot
it's not unsettling at all. And it's not a matter of like, when will there be no doctors there? Imagine, intermediary step where you have one doctor but 10 robotic surgeries going on at the same time, and he's just like checking them out for worst case scenarios where it exceeds the programming level of the robot.
I want there to always be like a person within running distance to my body. Yeah.
There's still going to be an anesthesiologist there.
Yes.
You still got to have the skin
robo anesthesiologist.
Yeah, there's going to be people in the room.
Exactly.
It's not about not having people there and involved. It's about what this is another example of something that we've talked previously on the show of how artificial intelligence allows you to replace the technical aspects of doing something. So like if you want to create a work of art, for example, how do you translate your creativity to the final product? Well, part of it is the creativity, and the other part of it is the technical skill to make it happen. But if you can remove the technical skill part because a computer can do that for you, then more people can express their creativity. And this way, if you know, like you can have like the medical, the surgical medical care is gets separated from the technical skill of like doing my tiny surgery with the needles, because a robot will just optimize the technical aspect of it, and you're managing the more creative intellectual aspects of it. So in that way, this could be a very good thing. And again, it will democratize surgical outcomes. And they chose this procedure for a reason, because it's tricky and the outcomes are variable and highly dependent on the skill of the surgeon. And if you could eliminate that technical skill component to make sure it's always optimal, that could have a huge impact on the practice of medicine.
And that's why it's not scary to me. It's actually really exciting, because, you know, like you said, there's still somebody in the room. There's still somebody making high level decisions. But you know that user error is not going to be why you had a surgical problem.
Right.
Right. Plus, you get superhuman sutures.
But there will be a transition period. There'll have to be the same thing happened with just laparoscopic surgery itself, you know, where it was very scary for everyone involved. It's like, so we're going to be poking around in somebody with, and they're not going to be open. And if something goes wrong, we're not there to fix it. It was scary for a while. And there was a learning curve until we got comfortable with it. But this is also part of, this was done laparoscopically, keep in mind. And this is a good thing too, because laparoscopic surgery, when you can do it, is so much better than having to open up a body cavity.
Oh, and
so this
may also, the infection rate goes way down.
Everything goes, the recovery goes way down, everything goes way down. So this would also, the purpose of this is to expand the number of surgeries that can be done scopically, you know, whether laparoscopically or thoracoscopically or arthroscopically or whatever, you know, just operating through a small camera, because robots are good at that. Yeah.
Right. Uberscopically.
Yeah.
Uberscopic. All right. Pretty cool. Good job, everyone. First sweep of the year.
Yay.
Oof. Yeah.
Glad I didn't lead you astray.
Congratulations.
I needed that one.
All right. Evan, give us a quote.
I love science. I hate supposition, superstition, exaggeration, and falsified data. Show me the research. Show me the results. Show me the conclusions. And then show me some qualified peer reviews of all of that. And that was written by a gentleman named William E. Vaughan, whom I had never heard of before today. American columnist and author. From St. Louis, Missouri, he wrote a syndicated column for the Kansas City Star from 1946 until his death in 1977.
Wow.
It was published in Reader's Digest, Better Homes and Gardens under the pseudonym Burton Hillis.
Good for him. What a great – that means he reached so many eyeballs.
Yes. The Reader's Digest used to be – oh, my gosh. Coffee table didn't have Reader's Digest on it back in those days.
I used to love the vocabulary quiz. I used to kick butt.
Yeah. I used to read the Reader's Digest all the time. I liked it.
I liked it too. I remember reading a ghost story in Reader's Digest that had me enthralled.
Ooh. Really?
Where the cool. The family was like, beds were shaking and stuff, and then somebody in the family decided to talk to the ghosts and say, "Please stop doing that," and then the ghost became friendly.
Awesome.
And they called him Casper.
That's right, Casper.
That's right, Casper. All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.